From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a look at how cranberry tariffs may impact local growers.
International markets are important to the Wisconsin growers and to the industry overall in North America. We probably export right now between 35 and 40% of the U.S. crop.
Then we hear from some of the demonstrators who traveled to D.C. for the March for Our Lives.
Later, we'll learn about a new play at First Stage Theater that uses stories of the community as a basis for the characters.
And Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Callum Graham describes how he plays so many parts with only two hands.
It's kind of like the guitar, I guess, with the piano. You have the right and left hand doing, you know, two very different parts. But how it all layers together, it's kind of like a human loop pedal. And it all works out.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Yesterday, China announced yet another set of tariffs targeting U.S. goods. This is just the latest move in the worsening trade war sparked by the United States' decision to set tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum.
Last week, the Chinese government announced tariffs on more than 100 other U.S. products, including a 15% tariff on cranberries. That move could have a tremendous impact on the economy here, as it's estimated that Wisconsin produces more than half the world's supply of cranberries. And foreign markets have accounted for much of the industry's growth over the last decade.
Tom Lochner is the executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. He sat down to speak with me by phone. Tom, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
So just to start here, how big is the cranberry industry in Wisconsin?
Well, cranberries are Wisconsin's largest fruit crop, and Wisconsin leads the nation in cranberry production. We produce between 60 and 65% of the U.S. crop here in Wisconsin. That amounts to probably 550 to 600 million pounds of fruit every year. We have an economic impact on the state's economy of almost $1 billion and provide jobs for about 3,400 Wisconsin residents. So it's a significant part of Wisconsin's diverse agriculture.
How important are exports to Wisconsin cranberry growers?
Well, exports and international markets are important to the Wisconsin growers and to the industry overall in North America. We probably export right now between 35 and 40% of the U.S. crop. And that's up from 5 to 10% just 15 or 20 years ago. So that's been a strong area of growth for sales for growers here in Wisconsin and growers nationally.
Yeah. So, of course, China announced these tariffs, 15% on both fresh and dried cranberries. How big is that market for cranberry growers?
Well, China is an important new market for us. We've just engaged China in trade and launched our program there. We have a small footprint that we're hoping to expand. The Federal Marketing Committee, which oversees our international efforts, identified China and India as the two new markets that they target markets that they were going to move into over the course of this year and the upcoming years. So China is an important market to us. We're looking to grow it, and we see it as an opportunity for growth. So anytime we get caught in some type of a trade dispute, that could negatively impact our course. So we're concerned about that, and we're looking and hoping that a resolution will come before the things get too far down the road here so that we can open that market in China for not only Wisconsin cranberries, but American cranberries in general.
Yeah, the EU is also considering tariffs on a number of U.S. goods, but they've specifically marked cranberries as a target. Does that concern you?
Well, the EU is our largest export market, and fortunately, there's been a suspension in the tariffs that the U.S. proposed to put on European steel and aluminum as well. And in response, the EU has withdrawn their proposal for retaliatory tariffs. So we've got some breathing room on that issue, and we hope to continue to have discussions with the EU to recognize that cranberries are a product that's not grown in Europe, so it's not a domestic product for them. And the real benefit of having cranberries available in the EU is the consumers of cranberries in the European Union, tariff would just cause the costs for those products and to the consumers in the EU to go up. And we don't see where that would benefit the EU or its the people there that enjoy cranberries.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, of course, they don't grow cranberries in the EU. But another thing that's been kind of on the table is renegotiating NAFTA. How big a market is Canada? How big a market is Mexico? And what would renegotiating NAFTA mean for cranberry growers in Wisconsin?
Well, there's a common theme to all of this, and that's free trade. And we believe in our industry has always promoted free trade between countries for a variety of reasons. But primarily, it's just that the flow of goods and services across borders benefits consumers and producers in both countries. And when you have free and fair trade, it raises the overall standard of living for both of the trading partners. So we've always supported agreements that remove trade barriers to allow products to flow across borders. Mexico and Canada are important markets for us. Canada, of course, produces their own fruit, but we do ship fruit into Canada as well as Mexico, which is one of the larger markets for U.S. cranberries and an important one. So in general, we're supportive of free trade and opening up markets rather than creating trade barriers.
So what's the next step for your organization and for cranberry growers here? Is there a way to kind of combat these tariffs, or are you sort of at the whim of diplomacy as far as this goes?
Well, for our organization in particular, our mission and our role is to assist growers in growing the crop and with other aspects of supply. The people in charge of marketing are working very hard in negotiating with whether it's trading partners in the European Union or China or India or elsewhere to hopefully maintain the ability and the reduced tariffs and to eliminate or suspend tariffs on cranberries and cranberry products. So there is work that's being done on that and negotiations. Of course, we obviously rely on diplomacy and people like the U.S. Trade Representative's Office and other people involved in those issues. But a lot of this is speculation right now. 2 weeks ago, there was a lot of speculation about what the EU tariffs were going to do, and we saw that situation cooled down a little bit. And instead of speculating, I think we need to make sure that we're dealing with what is exactly happening. And so a little bit of our response is prefaced on the fact that, you know, we are just speculating right now because we don't know exactly what the European Union, how that's going to be resolved. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with NAFTA, and we're not real sure what's going to happen with China as well. So we just caution people not to overreact to speculation, but we try and promote, again, free trade and free movement of goods and services across borders and try and reduce trade barriers rather than raise them.
So maybe checking back in 6 months or a year to see what's really happened.
Well, it's always an ongoing process, and trying to market food around the world is a challenge, and we have some very good people that work at it, and hopefully they're able to execute the strategies that are in place and open up some markets and sell more fruit, which hopefully will result in higher returns for our growers here in the U.S.
Higher returns and higher levels of vitamin C, right?
That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tom.
You bet. Thank you.
Tom Lochner is the executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. It's an organization which works to support local cranberry producers through education, environmental stewardship, and governmental policies.
A short break now, then we'll hear from some of the protesters who were in Washington, D.C. for the March for Our Lives. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Just days after the school shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, the students organized demonstrations for tighter gun laws. On March 24th, cities around the country formed marches in their own communities, and in Washington, D.C., around 800,000 people gathered to march for the changes that they want to see.
The diverse crowd included people of all backgrounds, of all ages, and with different reasons for marching. There were teachers like Mary Springer, who marches for the safety of her students. Claudia Delgadillo has this story.
The students are definitely sad, and when it happened, you know, yes, some of them said that they couldn't come to school because they were worried that someone was going to walk into the school.
What kind of change do you want to see after this?
I am really hoping that we are not thinking about a strategy to exit in case of someone with a gun walking into our schools. You know, it is sad to have that in mind pretty much on a daily basis. So I'm hoping that that fear goes away and that there's a regulation on the guns that are outside.
And then there's Jason Siebel of Franklin, Massachusetts, who used to belong to the National Rifle Association. But since the recent school shootings, he decided to leave.
I joined the NRA as a life member when I was 18, and after what happened at Sandy Hook, I got rid of my membership, and we are not gun owners anymore. My wife's mother was a teacher in Newtown, Connecticut, and while she was not in Sandy Hook, she was in the other elementary school. She spent that day locked in a closet and protecting her students, and she still is pretty broken up about the whole thing. And my views changed. And, you know, you're allowed to pivot. You're allowed to evolve. And I don't want I don't agree anymore with people owning weapons like that.
Veterans also gathered because they believe assault rifles are not for civilian use. Barbara Satansky is ex-Air Force.
I'm really impressed with the students who have stood up and the power that they are accumulating, and I'm excited that maybe really there's an opportunity now to really take down the NRA and take away their power and to try and get some changes done. I don't know why it's different for the students, but it is. You know, they were angry and they stood up right away and said, this is wrong, we're going to change it. And it's just, I just love this movement. I don't know. I'm just excited about it and I want to be a part of it.
For Sheila and Bob of Philadelphia, this isn't their first march on Washington. This time, they're here because their family has been affected by school shootings. However, it seems that no matter how much they march, they haven't seen much progress.
My nephew was at Virginia Tech, and one of his teachers was killed. And my daughter was in a high school where a student came in with an AR-15 and shot up a hallway and then killed himself in the school. So it's although we haven't lost anyone, it's still very personal to us because it does have a profound ripple effect on other families as well. It's hard at my age to be optimistic about seeing change on gun control after everything that's happened.
And would you say, is that why you come out to march?
No, I would have been here anyway. I mean, you know, it's more of a motivation, but I would have been here anyway. This just, to me, it's the gun laws at this point are just insanity.
Washington, D.C. frequently witnesses marches, but for Daniel Hyder, who's lived there his whole life, he had never participated in a march until now.
I've lived in Washington my whole life, and I've never really felt compelled to really march for something. And this is something that I think anybody no matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, somebody who likes to, you know, shoot guns recreationally or not, this is something that everybody needs to be in favor of. You know, I mean, I like to, you know, shoot clay pigeons and, you know, for fun and do, you know, trap shooting, but I'm not in favor of automatic weapons being able to be sold to anybody, and let alone, you know, a teenager.
While people from around the country traveled to support the students in Washington, D.C., the students themselves were there to share their stories of what happened that day. Brian Herrera is 17 years old and a student at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School.
We walked out for the fire drill, and then the kids in the front of my class saw him and immediately ran inside, and everyone got in the closet, and then we heard the gunshots. And then we waited in silence for around 4 or 5 hours, and then the SWAT team rescued us.
Did it feel like a normal school day going after that, or how did the teachers react, like, giving their class?
Absolutely not. It's still not normal. Teachers don't know what to do. They admit it. They tell us there's no plan. There's no for things like this. They're trying to get over. They're trying to do their best job too, because they're obviously devastated. So it's never going to be the same.
With him was his friend Ray Corniel, who is also 17.
So I actually heard gunshots, but it didn't sound like, it wasn't that loud, so it felt like fireworks to me. And then I just didn't wrap my head around that it was at where school was getting shot up. So it was very surreal.
And he lost someone close to him that day.
And my wrestling coach, Coach Hickson, was one of the person killed in the shooting. I was very close to him because I spent most of my time at the school with him every day after school and all weekends.
He explains how school is now for him.
Our school just seems like a prison now. We have to go to school with clear backpacks. We have like helicopters monitoring us. You hear walkie-talkies everywhere. You have to get checked by tons of like guards just to even go anywhere in the school. And it doesn't seem like a school anymore.
Now, after the shooting, they're doing anything they can to prevent this from happening again.
Earlier, we were talking to senators and congressmen. We went to a student summit at Capitol Hill, and we talked to them. And basically, all of this is just, you know, trying to make our voices heard and just doing everything we can to make a change.
I hope to wake up our politicians so they see that we are here and we are ready to make a change. And if they don't accept that, we'll vote them out. And we have so much energy. We're young. We're not old. We'll keep fighting until we get what we want.
Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo filed that story from the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C.
Coming up next, we'll learn about Antarctica, Wisconsin. It's not a place so much as it's a new play going up this weekend at First Stage Theater. Lake Effect continues right after this on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. And I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's First Stage Theater has been making award-winning theater since 1987. They're one of the country's most acclaimed children's theaters, and they've staged almost 50 premieres in their 31-year history.
One of those premieres is about to open, Antarctica, Wisconsin. It's a play about Milwaukee, about its divisions and its places of connection, and about a group of teenagers trying to navigate and better their world. Malkia Stampley directs the show, and Jeff Frank is First Stage's artistic director. He explains how this premiere came to be.
Finnegan Crookmeyer, the playwright, we commissioned him to write the piece The Snow a couple of seasons ago, and it was a great experience working with him. He's just got a unique voice, and his plays have been produced around the world. And I thought it was interesting what we might discover if we had a playwright literally from the other side of the world, because he lives in Tasmania. To come back to Milwaukee and talk with our young people in Milwaukee and see what he might discover, what story he might find to tell. And that was sort of the genesis, just a conversation about, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And then he had conversations with young people and then learned a lot from those conversations and then sent a survey to a broader constituency. So he had a lot of fodder to inform the beginnings of the piece.
How long was he here to actually do the in-person interview?
He spent about a week with us and then followed up with the surveys about 3 months later.
And Malkia, when did you get on board with it?
Oh, it has to be January of 2017.
Yeah, I think that's
so over a year. Yeah.
Over a year. I think there was a draft already in place or soon to be. and the interviews and conversations had already happened. And Jeff had talked to me about the project and his goals with the piece. And he was crazy enough to ask me to join. And so from there, you know, I started to work with Finnegan as well with a few others with our input in the drafts. And we had a couple workshops with actors and some young performers and really just worked on that script and trying to bring it to life. That was last year in April and then July. And then here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just about to open.
Right.
Just about to open. How has the rehearsal process felt? Because this piece has been created from scratch here.
It's been a whirlwind because it's such a different piece. You know, it's easy for me to want to get to the specifics, the what exactly is bothering our community today, yesterday. Let's be realistic and specific. And what I love about this is that it invites all kinds of audiences. So you don't have to pick a political side. You don't have to be on one side of a social issue. We recognize that there is something that's not right in our community that these young people are seeing and that we have to dig a little deeper and we have to join forces to try to correct some of these things. And so with that folktale element, it's for the entire family, but we're still able to at least show the essence or show the surface of some of the things that are plaguing our community in Milwaukee, specifically police brutality, violence in our neighborhoods, school, the lack of opportunities or not knowing what to do with your life when you are suffering from poverty and your voice not feeling like you have a voice. These young performers are talking about some really deep things without going to, like I said before, the more specific issues that, like the Parkland shooter or even the Sherman Park, the unrest in Sherman Park a couple years ago, which came out of this and other things. Because I feel that when you get very specific and when you pick those sides, even like Black Lives Matter, for instance, that's a trigger word. That's a trigger phrase for some people. If you say all lives matter, to me, that's a trigger phrase for me. But we chose not to go there because then people will shut off, I believe. And so I'm so pleased with where we've ended up with that.
One of the things I love about the way the script is written is that, A, it's told through the voices of these teenagers, and lots of them have the chance to be the narrator at the time. You know, everyone gets a chance to kind of speak how they see things. And as I was reading it, I didn't have necessarily a specific idea of what race these kids were. It was a mix. And it could be a lot of different things. And so it felt like it left room for everybody to find a place in it. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things, and Melkia talked about it a little bit, this idea that, you know, one of the reasons it's called Antarctica is because there's this metaphor of icebergs and the fact that we see a little bit of a person and we might make a judgment based on that little bit we see without knowing the totality of their story that lies under the surface, right? And the play itself is like that we see bits and pieces of the lives of these 17s on a couple of days at the end of a summer. Right. And in the midst of this struggle or all of the struggles that Milwaukee faces, they're just trying to be regular teens. But being a teen has become more and more complicated and more challenging. And we're hopeful that seeing different points of view, opening different minds, encourages people to find the deeper story of each individual and the deeper story of our community.
I found the play very gentle, that it was just this sort of, yes, there were problems. Yes, all of this. But there was sort of this loving embrace, if that makes sense, and gentle kept coming. It was just it was a way to look at some very difficult things without necessarily having the 2x4 hit you in the head about it.
Which I think is very important for our audience, because we don't want to turn anyone away. We don't want to shut anyone down with those harsh realities. But I feel that with our music and even the lighting and some of the movement, you get a sense that it's not just gentle. So that's been my job, trying to find that balance and not making it it's not just a fairy tale. It's not all light. There are some deeper issues. There's some rawness to it. And so the music, I think, helps bring that out. Josh Schmidt, who is our sound designer, he's sampling a lot of contemporary music, some Drake and some Phony People and other artists that our young people will know that I wasn't quite familiar with.
It's funny how fast that happens.
Right?
It's no longer your music.
Right. But we, during the first week of rehearsal, I had each actor come up with a playlist for their character. And our sound designer, he took that and then built this incredible soundscape for the show. And so I think you'll get that sense of heaviness with the show while they're trying to still be children. And that balance is beautiful.
Yeah, and when I say gentle, I don't mean that it's soft and isn't actually touching anything. Mm-hmm. But it seems the way that the play is getting to these difficult things is a softer way. It's not hiding the things. It's just saying, hey, you need to look at this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is really important.
Right.
This is affecting all of us.
Right.
And we don't necessarily know, like you were saying, Jeff, we don't know everybody's story.
Right.
We only know the tip of everybody's story.
Yeah. And I will say with the casting and how you can read the script and almost anyone could play any part, it made it difficult for us to cast it because then it becomes whose voice are we using as a platform? Who gets to tell this story? And I had to be very conscious of that. We have a set of twins in the show. And so, okay, if one is African-American, then the other has to be. Or, from the Latinx community, then the other. It was important that it was a diverse cast. And unfortunately, I found myself, at night, thinking about the play, thinking, what neighborhood in Milwaukee will you see a group of teenagers hanging out together that looks like our cast? I don't know, unfortunately. You may see them at Rufus King or, Reagan High School or High School of the Arts hanging out. But, in a neighborhood, where do you see that? Because Milwaukee is the most segregated city in the country, depending on what year. And so that became even more important to have it be diverse, because now we have an opportunity to put these teenagers, these actors together, and them coming from Muskego, Wauwatosa, Whitefish Bay, Washington Heights, 40th and Hampton. Now they're in a room and they get to talk about their experiences outside of this play, and they get to be the seeds in their schools. And maybe one day we will see our neighborhood on the corners, a group of kids, one being Jewish, one being Mexican, and one being mixed, and one being Black. Maybe one day we will see that. And with them, I just kept saying, hearing their thoughts, these young performers, their thoughts on what's plaguing their city, what makes them upset, and at the same time, what they love about their city. I found myself teary-eyed because they can articulate so well what they see is wrong. And they know, or at least they're confident, that they can fix it, or they are committed to making change. Mm-hmm. And that has been the most impressive part of it. It's not I'm leaving Milwaukee, I'm done with this place, I hate this city. It's what can we do to fix this place? And for them to be in that place right now at 14, 15, 16 years old, I have so much hope and faith in them.
Well, it kind of fits into the whole Parkland thing, too, where you say, wow, okay, those kids are going to save this.
Absolutely.
Because they are committed. And, and it's like you look back and think, yeah, and that's the age.
Right.
Before you get turned off and before you get hardened by right. everything, you need that hopeful, even if you see what's wrong and even if you see what the obstacles are, you're still going to go for it anyway.
Absolutely.
Attitude, that teenagers have.
Right. Dr. King, he needed the teenagers. He needed those young college students. The civil rights movement would not have happened without them. And we see that happening again 60 years later.
And that's the essence of why we do what we do at First Stage, right? We've always focused on giving young people a voice in the stories that we tell. And this is the most direct example, really going right to those teens and hearing what they had to say and shaping a story based on those things. And there's such a power in that, right? And we believe in young people at First Stage, right? We're not afraid to look into the darkness, right? But I always feel like our plays do point us toward the light. And I believe that these young people, and it's been amazing to watch them in rehearsals. That's some of the most powerful conversations I've witnessed in a rehearsal is listening to these people and the power of what they have to say. And I'm hopeful that with this piece, our community is really listening and furthering conversations after seeing the play. And there's some great there's a portrait and stories project that'll be a part of our lobby display. So community engagement manager, Lucia, coordinated an exhibit. So there are photos and stories throughout our lobby of different teens from all over Milwaukee, just adding on to all of the stories that we're not telling, but all the voices that need to be heard.
Now, there are a lot of other things going on in conjunction with the play. That's one of them. What else is happening? There's outreach and other things.
Sure. We're doing coordinating a number of listening circles, right? So we're bringing schools from different neighborhoods together to engage in listening circles with the Zeidler Center. We're also bringing some teens together to talk specifically about LGBTQ issues as well. So a lot of the things that, again, we're sparking conversation because of the different stories within the play and just trying to provide further opportunities, as we said, to continue the conversations that it doesn't end. And that's the other thing I love about the play is it's like the play is stopping, but the end of the story is not yet told.
Right. No, he doesn't wrap everything up. Mm-mm. Because there's still a lot to do. And one of the things we should mention also about the play, it's also very funny.
Yes.
It's really, I mean, there were times I snorted out loud with some of the lines that people have and some of the interactions that they have and the understandings that they have of human behavior at that age, you know. And it was just like, this is really great.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's a gift from Finnegan, too, right? Again, that we can look at these things. And sometimes people will feel like, oh, this is going to be a challenging play. It's going to make me think. I'm not sure I want to go, right? And he's able to wrap all of those deep, meaningful things in a really entertaining, funny, human, compelling, engaging package.
And it's got baseball.
Yeah.
What more can you ask for? Music, baseball, and people who want to change the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, Malkia, you know, she sort of jested, well, Jeff was crazy enough to bring me on for the project, but she's the exact right person to be dealing with this. She's somebody that grew up here in Milwaukee and has flourished and found a way and has such a deep love for the community, right? And that has been at the heart of the development of the piece. It's just watching her work and her passion for the piece and her passion for these young people and her passion for this city. It's been a blessing to have her at the helm for this one.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in today, Break a Leg.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks so much, Bonnie.
Jeff Frank is First Stage Theater's artistic director, and Malkia Stampley directs the company's newest premiere, Antarctica, Wisconsin. The show opens tomorrow night at the Todd Weir Theater in the Marcus Center and runs through mid-April. There's more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio performance from acclaimed Canadian guitarist Callum Graham. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. He's only 26, but Canadian fingerstyle guitarist and singer-songwriter Callum Graham has already performed at the Olympic Games in Vancouver and London, has released 5 acclaimed albums, and won some major Canadian music competitions.
Graham recently was named one of the top 30 guitarists under 30 by Acoustic Guitar Magazine, and he's in Milwaukee to perform tonight at the Helene Zelazo Center on the UWM campus. He stopped by the studio first and began with this tune called Three-Way Street. Thank you. Street Street, Callum Graham, in Lake Effect's performance studio. Welcome. My goodness, that was lovely.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I guess I want to start. I always never quite know where I want to go because there's a part of me that wants to know more about the technical stuff. And then there's a part of me that just wants to know where the inspiration for playing this way came from. So maybe we should start there. You started playing very young.
I started when I was 13. So right around that time, I discovered Don Ross, Canadian musician. And this is actually his guitar. And Don really showed me the groove and how, you know, throughout all his songs, it's so important that, you know, the groove is always there. And especially as a solo instrumentalist, you know, you've got to keep the time. And so that was actually a song that we did on the duet album we recorded, 1234. And that was kind of inspired by Don just keeping that backbeat. And then the melody is very simple on top. So the two layers, it's kind of like the guitar, I guess, with a piano. You have the right and left hand doing, you know, two different, very different parts. But how it all layers together, it's kind of like a human loop pedal. And it all works out.
I love that, human loop pedal. And there is something mesmerizing about watching you perform that, because we see, and when people see you in concert, they'll see the same thing. You know, you're all over the instrument, and somehow all of that polyrhythm stuff is happening, and the groove is happening, the melody is happening, the harmonies are going on, and somehow it all happens with two hands.
Mm-hmm. Miraculously.
It is pretty, yeah. So Don Ross, big inspiration, and I can understand why. Brilliant, brilliant musician. When did you decide this is what I want to do all the time?
I think after I heard his first album, Bering Strait. At the time I was in high school and listening to like punk rock and metal, you know, angst phase. And then one day my guitar teacher was playing this cassette by Don Ross, and the song First Ride came on. I'm like, wow, that's cool. It's like three guitars playing. He's like, no, that's one guy. And my head exploded at that moment, and I thought, that's what I want to be doing. So I put down the electric guitar and just been playing the acoustic since.
When you are working out a song, how are you working out those parts? You know, what's the process for you? Do you work out each one individually and then kind of layer them, or are you kind of working on them concurrently?
It's different for everyone. It's kind of, songwriting is kind of like a puzzle, you know, and you get some pieces that fit together here. Sometimes you make the border first, then fill it in. Every song is kind of a different puzzle challenge, if you will. You know, it all is put together differently every time. For me, the most important thing, though, throughout all of it, aside from technical, what, you know, whatever you're doing, is the melody, and that, you know, what I'm playing on the guitar transcends the guitar. So it's not just, you know, a song on the guitar. It's music that you could, you know, you could hum the melody and you could play it on a different instrument. So I try and not think with the guitar so much and think more in a musical term, with the melody kind of dictating most of the decisions in my writing.
Then what you're essentially doing after that is arranging it.
Yeah, pretty much so.
That's
yeah,
really cool.
And storytelling part of it, you know, the beginning and middle and end, all that.
And you mentioned storytelling, and that's such an interesting thing, because I think most modern fingerstyle guitarists have that in common. Most people are trying to tell a story through what they're doing, mostly without words. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have lyrics most of the time. And with these layers of sound and layers of rhythm, there's usually some sort of through line that's going on. For you, when you're writing or when something comes to you, is it like an idea about a feeling, again, depending on the song?
Usually, feeling and emotion will start something, and that will kind of lead me to other ideas and say, oh, okay, this could segue here, go into that. And then, through repetition and then, okay, need a new section, come back to it. So, it's all very interesting how it goes together. It's just a giant mess, to be honest. The creative process is a mess, and it's, you know, how do the puzzle pieces fit together? But ultimately, if you're patient with it and determined, can get some pretty cool results.
And be a good editor, too.
Yes, that's a big part, too.
They say in journalism, kill your puppies. It's like you love it, you love it, you love it, but it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to say it doesn't work in this story. It doesn't work in this song.
Big time. And I learned that when I was co-scoring. I had the opportunity to have my music co-scored in a IMAX film on humpback whales. And that was a big part of the process, was that we wrote so much music and then, you know, the directors would be like, no, it's not what we're looking for. Go back to the drawing board and write a whole bunch more. And then, like you said, kill your puppies. So.
Did you save any of the stuff that they rejected for the film?
Yes, actually. I wrote one piece I can play on the harp guitar and have this really beautiful theme for a visual that we were really trying to get. And I felt like it fit well. And they're like, yeah, it's just not what we're looking for. So I kind of scrapped the song and came back to it, found it a couple years later. And I'm like, hey, that's actually pretty good. I should finish that. So
can we hear the one that on the harp guitar that you wrote for the film that they didn't take?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
thank you so much. That was Farewell on the Most Beautiful Harp Guitar I think I've ever seen. That is just a gorgeous instrument.
Right.
I have to ask how the bass strings are tuned, the harp strings.
Well, this is actually tuned way down to a D, and just goes up kind of a minor scale from there. D, E. It changes sometimes major, minor, and I have these little sharping levers, kind of like you can do the Jaws theme. And you can do really quick tuning changes. And but
does that
yeah,
take
it's
it up a tone, a half tone or a tone?
Yeah,
or?
Semitone.
Semitone.
So
okay.
It's usually just I keep it in kind of a minor scale, major scale, depending on the song.
Is there a standard tuning for a harp guitar, or is it pretty much player's choice?
I guess like Stephen Bennett is one of the most well-known, well-recognized players, and he's kind of got a Stephen Bennett standard harp guitar tuning. But it's way up. I think his starts at an E, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, this is pretty low. When I told the luthier I wanted to go down to a D, are you sure? It's a lot of tension.
Is it harder to keep
tension.
It? Yeah, is it harder to keep it in tune with it?
Yeah,
taken
well,
down that
it's a the string here is about a 90 gauge, which is like
yeah, it's huge,
it's massive. It's
it almost looks like a cello string.
Yeah, it pretty much is. And yeah, if it's tuned any lower, it just turns into a bunch of spaghetti. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful sound. Now, coming from a standard six string, and I know guitarists do all kinds of tunings depending on the song that they're playing, open tunings or partially open tunings. When you add these other six strings, it's not a standard 12-string guitar. You've got something very different going on because you're not fretting them. Was there a learning curve for you to like feel that you had any competency on this, or was it pretty quick?
Yeah, it took me a little while to – I mean, for one, looking down and usually seeing 6 and seeing 12 is kind of like, whoa. Whereas the – it's very unfamiliar at first. But, I mean, it's – the way I think of it now is kind of like you have your regular acoustic guitar on the bottom. And then if you memorize the strings that you have it tuned to, as you said, there's no frets. So if you can memorize, the different chords, like you've got a D – so you can play that, an E, F sharp. Come to an A, and then this one goes to B. So if you can memorize that, then it kind of gives you a little bit of a map around it. But yeah.
Well, and just that progression alone was very beautiful.
Yeah,
just going right down the strings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I could hear all kinds of melodies against that.
Oh yeah,
that basic movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I know in your solo performances you do more standard guitar, and you're doing harp guitar stuff as well. Have you composed on this yet?
I have. That was actually one of my songs.
That was the first one you composed on,
yep.
Or one of the first?
Farewell, that's right. Yeah, I've written a couple songs for it and worked a little arrangement of a Michael Jackson tune. That was kind of the first one that came to mind when I got this guitar. It's like, okay, now what the heck am I going to play on it? And there was a MJ song on the radio, and I thought, I wonder if I can figure that out, do the bass part with the harp and then the guitar part here and sing, do the moonwalk at the same time and wear a white glove. You know.
On which hand, though?
Yeah.
And I know that's the one we're going to go out with. But before we do, before we hear the whole thing, how did you figure out what to do with the bass? And we're talking about Billie Jean. The song is Billie Jean. A lot of people have covered it. And so what were you trying to achieve by putting it onto this instrument?
Well, like you said, I guess you've had another guitarist, Gareth Pearson, in here who does it all on the acoustic, and it very much works on just the one. But I just thought utilizing – I haven't seen a lot of harp guitar players that really utilize the harp strings kind of like Hedges did, Michael Hedges, where he would kind of use it as these melody lines. And more than just like I was showing you there with an open string – rather than just having that nice bass kind of resonate while you play, to have an active part that's, like the bass line in that song. So it took me a little while, and the tuning on it is really weird, but it works out so that I'm able to somehow do the bass line with my right hand and keep the rest of the song going to the left. So, yeah, took a long time to get it down.
Well, we are going to hear it. But before we do, I want to say to Callum Graham, thank you so much for coming in, playing for us. It's such a pleasure to have you in Milwaukee.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Bonnie.
More like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who will dance in the round. She said, I am the one who will dance in the round.
She told Guitarist Callum Graham performs tonight as part of UWM's MKE Unplugged series. The concert starts at 7:30 and takes place at UWM Zelazo Center for the Performing Arts. The concert is free, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
And that's also where you can hear all three tunes that Callum played for us, Three-Way Street, Farewell, and Billie Jean. That wraps up the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Who claims that I am the one? But that kid is not my son. She said I am the one. That kid is not my son. 40 days and 40 nights, I was on her side. But who can stand when she's in demand? Her schemes and her plans are, 'cause we dance in the round all night long. She told my baby we danced at three. She looked at me, showed a photo of a baby crying. His eyes looked like my eyes, 'cause we dance in the round. So take my strong advice and always think twice. People always told me to be careful what you do. Don't go around breaking young girls.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.